Call is now being recorded.
And we're on.
Wow, fancy.
Right? Did you say flimsy?
Yeah, what's going on? How's your Halloween?
My Halloween was excellent. It was just family and friends and nothing too fancy.
Yeah, it's nice that way.
How about yours? Yeah.
Yeah, Maxine was a princess, which is, I guess, princess for girls was the number one costume in 2012. For boys, it was Batman. But she was a princess, and then the little one, Roxanne, was a ladybug. And we actually went to the mall.
Huh?
Yeah, it was pretty cute. I'll send you a picture. But we went to the mall, which was cool because we got there too late. And everybody had already run out of candy, which is cool because it's way too much candy. There's like,
I know.
It's a pandemic of
I know.
Sugar.
Well,
it's not right.
We're gradually heading into the topic, in a way, according to my view of it.
Oh,
but
your compass.
Well, what?
According to your compass.
Yes, sort of. Yes, yeah. I have to think about that for a second, but yeah. Our society influences, you know, some people are saying we're going to hell in a handbasket, but they've been saying that always. And I mean,
I think it's a spiral. It's a progressive spiral upward. You know, I think we're getting, I mean, you could shoot a gay guy 100 years ago and people would be like, well, he was gay, you know? So, I mean,
right.
I think we're doing better, but it's always been really sick is the thing. So, and we're more exposed to all those dark corners because of technology.
Yeah, and that's what I'm coming around to thinking when it comes to zombies.
Zombies, yeah.
I'm thinking
the headlines all the time these days. I don't know what's going on with zombies.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's very noticeable.
Yeah.
And I'm saying, what...
No, go ahead.
And obviously, the dead are not really walking. I mean, between you and me, I mean, we can have that discussion.
Well, you need to deconstruct the whole zombie thing. I mean, you know, zombie is an actual thing. It comes from Haiti, part of a religious belief. You know, if you believe in voodoo, that this you can actually animate the dead.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you start with that point, and then now you know. I was just telling somebody the other day, oh, no, I was watching Abraham Lincoln versus the zombies.
Right.
And it was
That's
really
a
well
movie? I thought that was a book.
It was
Oh, right, there was a movie.
It was also a film. They made a film of it. And but the book that came up in discussion because of that film was Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. I don't know if you've heard
right.
of that book. But it did very well. It's doing very well. And just that the, incorporation of the zombie into the zeitgeist. And you don't often get to alliterate with the letter Z, by the way. But the zombie zeitgeist has been, I don't know, maybe it's the role that the archetype plays for voodoo, for example, that is of a possessed body, somebody whose will is no longer their own, and they're sort of just going through the motions of life. Maybe it resonates with a modern audience, this idea that you're soulless, you know, that you, I don't know. It's been embellished, obviously, with the brains eating. I don't think that was a voodoo thing. That's kind of a Night of the Living Dead thing.
Well, that came up with Night of the Living Dead.
Yeah, right, the whole brains. And then it took a kind of campy note, you know, the camp, send more cops, you know, send more brains. All that
stuff. Was a good movie. That was Return of the Night of the Living Dead.
Yeah, that was a good one. That was a really good one. The original one was good, too, but it was more like slow, creepy guy, and I'll just eat your flesh.
That was genuine scary.
Yeah, that was really scary. And that was also a great portrayal of a young black man. I don't know if you remember the film, but...
I kind of do.
It doesn't really refer to his race at all, in a way. It was like a true... picture of like colorblind casting or, you know, like where somebody is just playing a guy and it doesn't matter if he's black. But also the actor played him with such dignity and, well, you know, the kind of things that, you know, you say about Sidney Poitier at the time, that, oh, here's a guy who's so dignified as if, you know, there's a jewel in the rough. But no, I mean,
and so that tells us something about the whole movie, too. I mean, it tells us that it's made by somebody who's progressive and who has, well, I mean, yeah. I don't even know if progressive is too,
de facto progressive. I mean, there are very few instances where, A, a black guy carried the movie, and B, he was presented in a positive note,
right.
And C, his race almost doesn't matter. Like, it was, you know,
right.
It had no significance.
Which had to have been, you know, a very conscious decision. I mean, it's not like you just, you know, it's not like he just didn't think, the director didn't think about it. I mean,
I don't know. What's his name?
Maybe not.
George, huh?
No, wasn't that Romero?
Know. Yeah, it was Romero. And from what I remember from interviews, it's him. He did sound like a pretty, like, modern guy and no bullshit, you know. But I don't know what his particular views were for casting that actor, that guy, for that show.
I wonder if there's any interviews.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be a neat thing to listen to, some George Romero interviews.
Okay. When he introduced the idea of eating brains to the zombie myth.
Which are we agreeing is probably around Return of... Or what is it? Return of the Night of the Living Dead or something like that?
Oh, I don't know. Was it not in the original?
I don't think they ate brains. I think they were just like slow walking, arms out, crashing through boarded up windows, trying to get you and eat your face, you know, eat your body.
Mm.
But I don't think it was like they loved brains, you know, per se. I think that...
Well, whenever the brains eating comes,
yeah.
That's an example of something... You know, okay, the interesting thing about our times is that unlike in the pre-literate days when you didn't know where contributions to the culture came from, we can actually say when this started, but it was taken up and adopted by the culture, just like crucifixes for vampires and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And so that means
lore.
The people...
Became part of the lore. Part of the folklore.
Which means that we recognized that it made sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, it doesn't, I mean, garlic doesn't make sense to us anymore, though. That's the thing. It kind of falls in and out. Our sensibilities are slightly
right,
different.
Right.
You know, the cross, the crucifix I get, and the holy water, all that stuff I get. Sunlight, I'm not too sure, but I think I can work with that one. The garlic, I have absolutely no connection to that. There must have been something about garlic way back in the day that resonated with that audience.
Right.
I don't know.
That doesn't anymore.
Pundity? Basic analysis or some of Freudian or psychoanalysis of it, it must be that there's something really good about garlic and there's something really...
Right.
Garlic in your house for some reason. You should, you know, keep garlic around. The idea being maybe that, you know, like in that one documentary, garlic is as good as 10 mothers. About the Gilroy festival. Maybe there's something really hearty and healthy about garlic that somehow that Romanians at the time needed to learn, or Transylvanians, whoever they are.
What did you... Yeah, I mean, definitely those people were, I think, very garlic-centric. So
yeah.
That, like, that and Christianity, it makes sense that those would be the things that would fight evil. And then
right.
That we would have dropped that, but kept the Christianity because we're still a Christian society.
Right.
Did you say something about Kilroy?
Yeah, they have a garlic festival every year. And there was a documentary made of it, and the film is called Garlic is as Good as 10 Mothers. And it's also by another famous director. I don't think it was, no. Wurzog? No, could be Wurzog. I don't think so, but hello?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. But so, I mean, I don't know if vampires have been deconstructed.
Well, the vampire bat is the only animal that really does what a vampire is said to do. And that is, aside from the, you know, mythical chupacabra, it actually eats the whole, it sucks the whole goat. It's the one animal that with its two teeth, you know, will go up to mammals and suck their blood in order to survive. So that's a South American thing. I don't know how it got over to, you know, Europe.
So do you think there's anything in that the vampire comes from South America and voodoo comes from Haiti? And I mean, zombies might come from Haiti.
Well, I don't know. You'd have to do some kind of anthropological study to see if there's any significance about certain phenomenon based on their, you know, relationship with the equator or drop.
All right. Well, we obviously don't have time for that.
I think that's outside my purview.
Yeah. But let's stick to just wild speculation then.
Yeah, let's stay on topic.
I theorized, I, Nick Richard, and this year have theorized that zombies represent like consumers.
Mm-hmm.
And, they eat brains because they, you know, they want to have actual thoughts, but they don't know how to have their own. So when they see, but you can't get thoughts by eating somebody else's brain, so it doesn't solve their problem at all. They just have to keep consuming, and they're never full.
That's true. They never stop. It's an insatiable desire to eat brains. Let me just throw this out there. Funny, the only way to really kill a zombie is to blow his head off.
What does that mean?
I don't know, but obviously there's some connection with this, the head.
Yeah, there's something about brains going on. And when did that start? Was that in the original Night of the Living Dead?
I don't know. Was he able to you know, take out zombies by blowing their heads off? I can't remember if that was in the original. But at some point, I don't know when that came up. That'd be an interesting one to figure out.
I remember one scene from, I guess it was Return of the Night of the Living Dead. Or is it Return of the Living Dead?
Return of the Living Dead.
Where there was just like, it was like a head and a spinal cord. Oh, it might have been arms. It might have had arms. But, I mean, it was all about central nervous system.
Well, you know, I think there are in some schools of zombie thought that no matter what you do, the thing is going to be animated. You almost have to like burn it or something. Like you can chop the head off, but it'll keep talking, or the body will keep trying to walk. But there are those that think that you can definitely terminate the animation of a zombie.
I haven't
watched any of this. You know, to be honest, I'm not a fan of zombies. I'm not a fan of the genre. I don't watch The Walking Dead. I don't really go to see those zombie movies. I think, in fact, Return of the Zombie Living Dead was probably the last time I sat through a whole zombie film. Except, I did watch significant portions of Shaun of the Dead. Oh, that's right. Dawn of the Dead is one, too, right? But I did watch Shaun of the Dead, and I only watched that more for its comic value. Despite its zombie motif, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's something about zombies that's totally uninteresting to me. Although, you know what we saw in, that was vampires. I'm sorry, that was Lincoln and vampires. That was not zombies. Because the vampires, they have agency, you know. They have societies and histories and, you know, political aims and stuff like that. They really do have, sort of an agenda. The zombies, it's like, you just gotta run away from them, you know? It's like, you gotta keep running and with your face. And
I find it really fascinating, if only for the fact that they are taking off. And some people might say that, like, the corporations are deciding, like, I know somebody, my other friend Steve, who said that corporations have decided to make zombies popular. But I don't believe that. I think that it has resonated with people. And I'm just curious, like, why? Why now? And, yeah. You know, like with anything, you know, I mean, kids have a new hot toy every couple years, you know?
Right.
And I think that says something, but when adults have something, yeah.
But have we had enough of a period of study to know that it's not just a fad of some sort? Like, you know, after 10 years, nobody will really care about zombies anymore. 5 years.
No, I think it might be a fad, but I mean, even if it's just a fad, what a strange fad.
Yeah. Yeah. Wasn't there like a training you can go to for zombie apocalypse or something like that? I think reading that book
sure there...
years ago. And that was, like, that was seen as some kind of, you know, cultural marking point where zombies have become, or like zombie crossing. Somebody put up a street sign that said zombie crossing.
Anything but, that hasn't, yeah.
Right, I was going to go back to, as you say, going back to my earlier point, which is your point, is that, you know, this idea of a will-less corpse somehow may be resonating in today's audience, a larger audience, where, you know, people do go to work you know, they're commuting or their work sucks and they feel like zombies. Like, I remember having a shitty job 9 to 5 that you had to take the bus to early in the morning. And after, you know, a few months of that, you do feel like you're devoid of and joy, really, which is akin to being having a soul, you know, unless you can make that happen for yourself somehow.
Well, but isn't that the history of human beings on this planet, having to,
no,
you know,
no,
slave?
No, not necessarily. I think modernity, you know, people argue, you know, if you look at those old Charlie Chaplin films, what was that one, Modern Times, where you see the machine actually physically consuming people. And robbing people, you know, you become a number and your individual character. I think around that time, you know, industrialization came around and modernity came, and it really, it was, you know, the individual versus society and the machine at that point. And we just become a number in 1984, all that stuff, where you're talking about your day.
So you're saying that this is something that is unique to industrial times?
Well, not just industrial times, but modernity. These ideas of metropolises, these giant places where the individual can get swept up, and even the institutions are gigantic, you know, and run like systems and machines. And you know, we have numbers, IDs, and social security numbers. And before that, you can have an industrial society like, you know, early 1900s, where ritual was still part of the community. Communities were smaller. Didn't have mass production. That really started around it started in the 1880s with Quaker Oats and all that stuff. But it didn't really pick up until 1920 or so. And that's when you start seeing these giants, these films, you know, like Charlie Chaplin and the guy hanging off the clock on the giant building. That's when, you know, towering this little guy on a big giant building. You don't see those prior to 1920. And the idea is, I think, the modern society has crushed the individual and there's no more soul. You know, you clock in this giant, you know, you remember those old 50s clock punchers, clocking in, clocking out. And so the ritual has become the corporations or the workplaces, you know, the individual no longer is part of this communal ritual that you used to do, you know, maypole dances or whatever it was, even, you know, frog jumping contests or whatever it was back before, prior to modernization, that's been taken away from the individual.
I don't see the difference between modernization and industrialization.
Well, I think if they're cousins, I mean, or it's like it's a ring in a tree, you know. Industrialization, you can have factories, but you don't have the mass production. You don't have the sort of the metropolises that you see around, after, you know, post-1900. You don't have the conspicuous consumption. You don't have that sort of.
But I mean, you know, when you look at like
a bunch of cans, but you don't have a label on it that says what it is. You know, that's the difference between industrialization and modernization.
But industrialization happened it's like once you had industrialization, it seems like modernity was inevitable. I mean, it basically is the child of industrialization.
Well, I think industrialization is a component that led to modernization, but there are other things at play besides. It's not a river going into another larger body. It's like several rivulets entering the larger body of modernity.
Then what else besides industrialization led to modernity in your view?
There was a change in sensibilities in psychiatry and that whole psychoanalysis. It changed the way people saw themselves in the world. You know, kind of like the difference between Copernicus and Galileo, you know, having a Earth-centric view versus a solar-centric, heliocentric. You know, people began to see themselves as individuals. The whole study of dreams and psychoanalysis led people to believe, and the diagnosis of psychological ailments and the treatment of psychological ailments pulled people away from sort of a groupthink to like, hey, what do I need? What's good for me? You know, and that was a significant shift in sensibility right around the same time as industry was turning into mass production.
It's ironic that mass production would lead to an increase in individualism.
Well, you know, there's one aspect of it. You see it a lot. It's funny because that is one significant consequence of mass production is you have the automobile, right? Henry Ford. He starts making all these cars. And so for the first time in a long time, teenagers can get in their car, or, you know, young men can go pick up a young woman, get in a car, and get away from everybody else, far away. You start to see people staying at home, listening to their radios, not congregating in groups. You know, the medium became the subject. You know, it's like having a radio was all of a sudden the thing.
Okay, so and that leads right. What were you going to say?
Well, it just atomizes people. It made people become more individual, more positive.
Yeah, if you look at, do you remember Marshall McLuhan?
No, who's that?
The medium is the message.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
The idea of that is very simple. It's, there's multiple ideas in that, and it's not that simple. But the technology is the message apart from anything that is carried over the technology. Like the radio itself is the message. The
right.
TV itself is the message. The internet is the message.
Yeah.
And like I think, you know, the factories and the assembly line was the message. And today, the message is decentralization. And I don't think we've begun to see what the fallout is from that, but our culture is going to change because of the technology.
But that's always been the case. I think what we're recognizing is how much of an impact it is. I mean, I don't know if before Gutenberg, people afterwards were like, this is really going to, you know, technology really does play a part in how we absorb culture. You know, I don't think they were coming to that conclusion. They were just
it made everybody a reader instead of just priests.
Right, but they weren't aware of how significant
that culture. But they might have been. I'm sure a lot of people realized.
The study of social sciences wasn't. You know, we have reams and reams and volumes of ways to study culture now that never existed prior to, you know.
I don't think you needed to be a social scientist to realize, you know, the people are reading and it's partly because they have books in their hands.
No, you don't need a social scientist for that, but you do need one to tell you, hey, this is significant because it's going to shift culture in these directions, and you know, archetypes or themes that had existed prior to, or values, you know, mores, cultural mores are going to be shifting. You do need a social scientist to sort of interpret the dynamics when it comes to social change, I think. You know, sure, anybody can tell you, hey, everybody's reading Gutenberg, you know, made that change, but you can't tell, you can't also make it a mass awareness. That is, a lot of individuals who are not social scientists can now comment because of, like, pop social science, let's say, like pop psychology. You and I both can talk about neuroses that we hear about, learn about, talk about, because it's part of the general zeitgeist. That's because that particular discipline has been popularized, right? In social science, I think, in a way, it's the same. You know, people can comment on cultural and social change in a way that you don't need to be an expert. You don't have to have expertise to still contribute to the conversation.
Expertise. You know, they should have, like, tea parties where only experts are invited.
Yeah, it'd be awesome. I'm sure you'd learn a lot. I mean, but then, I mean, nobody would learn anything, I guess, because unless it's just, are they experts in different things?
Well, I mean, I think experts can learn from other experts in the same field.
Oh, yeah. Okay, that's true.
Or they could be experts in different things.
That sounds like a more interesting tea party.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah,
like animal husbandry over here, and you have, like, I don't know, parachuters.
Did you hear about the new parachuting where you throw the parachute out of the plane and then jump out after it and go get it?
Yeah, I did read a little blurb about that. It doesn't sound like that's the new parachuting. That's like the new risking your life fad in a crazy way. Like, I can't imagine, like, there's a parachuting class that's going to be like, hey, this is the new thing.
I'm not doing that.
Well,
Have you ever
done it, though?
You know, no. I went up in an airplane with an expert parachuter and talked about doing it on the ride up, and I just decided that, you know, if anything went wrong with the chute or anything, I would just feel like, well, that was dumb.
You would probably feel like that, but what happened if that didn't happen? How would you feel?
Then I would have done a sky. It's the, you know what? The risk is not worth the reward in that particular case, in my opinion.
Well, so wait. But I've done it twice. I did it once in my 40th birthday, I think, in June. Then I did it again a month later.
How was it?
It was fun. It was really, really fun.
I want to get
40,000 feet.
40,000 feet.
Yeah, a little rickety plane.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like you can barely fit in there.
I want to get back to the subject of, I know I had some way of trying to wrap it up, of zombies because,
yeah, zombies.
What was it?
Well, do you watch Walking Dead?
Yes, I do.
Do you watch it?
Yeah, that happened to me, yes.
Okay, I don't know much about it. It looks cool. I don't buy into the zombie thing, man. I can't tell. I don't know what it is. I just don't like, it grosses me out on some level, the eating the faces and the body parts falling off. So I take it to, like,
I got it now.
Yeah.
I got it. Here's my theory.
Yeah.
Or one theory. This kind of stuff that we're seeing on TV, people eating people's faces,
mm-hmm.
although, of course, you still can't see a naked breast.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's just a whole other conversation. But eating people's faces on TV and basically, you know, that being out there for our culture, I feel like maybe this is a sign of the ultimate democratization of our culture.
The democratization of what?
Of our culture. Because this is like, you know, it used to be that culture was, well, certain kinds of culture, like,
yeah, but
the kind of culture.
You can't show a breast. How is that democratized?
I don't know. I don't know how that fits in.
Collective democratization. You know, violence is fine. You know,
here's what I was going to say.
Sell guns.
The what?
The NRA wants to sell guns. They want, you know, people to be armed. They want, and violence is sort of, has a different worth in the commodity. You know what I mean? It's a different commodity. Whereas sex, I don't know. I don't think it's as strong as violence.
Well, okay. Here's the second part of my theory is that this could be sort of a way in which the real harshness of life is being represented.
Okay.
The toughness of life.
Right, like the Brothers Grimm.
You know? Hmm?
Like the Brothers Grimm?
Like, exactly, yeah, exactly. Like, when people were in charge of their own culture, they told stories in which all this mutilation was happening. You know, but at least in the Brothers Grimm tradition, they did not tell stories in which somebody took her top off and you could see her full breasts.
Well.
With nipples.
You're saying in the oral tradition, people didn't really comment on anatomy?
Yeah, they didn't say and you could see her, you know, her labia. But they did say, like, but they did say, like,
her vulva, this or something like that.
What?
They would just use euphemisms for beauty or lust or something like that.
Yeah, they would use, like, metaphors or, yeah, but, but they did have graphic violence. You know, like, they poked in Cinderella, you know, the sisters cut their feet off to fit into the slipper, or at the end, crows poked their eyes out.
Right, right.
I mean, that's not any less gruesome than The Walking Dead.
Hansel and Gretel, like throwing, you mentioned pies and throwing people in ovens and stuff.
Right.
People a lot. Crazy.
Right. We're getting back to the point where, like, the folk are sort of deciding what our culture is about. It's like folk culture in a way. It's like a mix between money and folk culture.
Well, I think the key word there is mix. I mean, it's part of a mix. We're no longer, I mean, we are so balkanized. There's no way there's one swath that anyway I can see. I'm sure with the hindsight of, you know, 20 years of history, you can look back and say, oh yeah, you can see sort of a meta narrative or some scene going on here. But right now there's so much going on so many different levels, even individually, like on the different levels that you engage, whether it's what you watch on TV or what you listen to musically or who you talk to in real life, you know, but negotiating those different platforms is enough for one person, I would think. And then on top of that, you have a nation of Twitter feeds, you know. So it's hard to determine right now, you know, if you want to use your popular social scientist cap to really see what the sort of guiding cultural, you know, dynamic is really. The zombies is almost like a beehive. It's one little octagon and several.
Well, you know, that's interesting. I'm not seeing it like that, because it seems to me like, I mean, if we are balkanized, which, I mean, the world has always been, and I think less so now than before, maybe.
Way more balkanized than we were before, because nowadays people can just listen to what they want to listen to, talk to who they want to talk to, both physically. They move to communities that increasingly are people more like them, and then what they watch on TV and listen to on the radio and where they get their sources of information are increasingly people that are just like them. You know, it used to be three.
It's possible that in the future that'll be the case, but more people, like Walking Dead, crosses all boundaries.
Well, I can't speak on it. I haven't seen it. But
I mean, but there's no group. There's no group of people that doesn't watch
it. That watches it, or what?
Yeah. There's no group of people that doesn't watch The Walking Dead. I mean, Christians watch it. Goth people watch it.
Is it on cable? Or is it on radio?
Yeah, it's on cable.
So poor people don't watch it.
Who?
Poor people, like people who can't afford cable.
You can't say poor people don't watch Walking Dead.
Well,
it's on Netflix. Well, it's on Netflix too.
Which you have to pay like $8 a month, right? You know, it's a lot of dough.
Yeah, but you know, everybody knows somebody who's got Netflix or cable.
I think you overestimate the capacity of the working poor to be able to watch cable.
Well, I appreciate your defending the working poor.
Well, it's no defense.
But
it's an observation.
Oh, I know. It makes me feel like you're saying, like, I don't understand the working poor. And I, my friend, understand that. No, I don't.
What I'm trying to show is that maybe there's some part of the demographic that is not bought in or has no buy-in into the, into any.
Yeah, I that's interesting. I would like to see, are there statistics on
that,
you know.
That would be interesting. Like, how do people without cable and who don't have cable because they can't afford it end up watching cable shows? Like, what do they do? Do they go to Nick's house who has Netflix? And then and that's technically not cable, is it? That's streaming. That's live streaming. So
what?
Netflix? Walking Dead is both on cable and live streaming? Or streaming?
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's both. But, you know, Netflix is $8 a month.
Yeah, but I'm
now,
telling you, if you're going to cut back and you're, like, way behind on your this and your that, that's
yeah, I don't know. If you have, is it $8 for Netflix? If you have a family of, like, four and you got two kids,
yeah,
and, you know, nobody in America is making $1 a day who's working.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's just other countries. That's, you know, and, I mean, there might be some people for whom, really, that's a hardship.
What if
but
you're
the unemployed,
people who don't work, you know, they lost a job.
Do you know people like this?
I've worked, I meet a lot of poor folks, and they're barely making it, man. And I just don't see them paying Netflix.
Well,
they're government assistance or, you know, this or that. But for one reason or whatever, they're really down on their luck.
I've been working in the LA Unified School District for the past 15 years.
Yeah.
And one thing that everybody notices is that no matter how poor kids are, they have cell phones.
Okay.
I mean, it might, whether it's true or not. I mean, that's what.
Now
that's what
I won't argue. All these folks that I've known, when I ask for their information, there's a cell phone that I can call. There's always a cell phone you can call. I feel that that purchase is slightly different than the purchase to watch streaming video on your television at home.
Yeah, but when you have that computer in your pocket and you have the internet,
yeah.
I think, you know, knowledge at least of Walking Dead and is really hard to avoid.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'll have to sit that debate out. And I'd love to see what the more anecdotal evidence, I guess, if, you know, I don't know if you got kids at school that may, you know, be working, their parents not working or finding it hard and still able to watch Netflix. I'm curious to see how that works.
Well, I mean, maybe they're watching it in the hallways on the phones of kids who can't afford Netflix.
Ask them.
You're right. I'm taking this year off, though. I'm not working this year.
Huh?
I'm not working this year. I'm taking the year off, so I'd have to go.
Oh.
Take a survey, which...
Go out of your way once in life. Sorry, I'm cracking myself up over here. Hey, I'm sure you've gone out of your way plenty, especially with those kids. I know how hard you work with them, so I'm just giving you a hard time.
Thank you.
So zombies. Yeah, I'll tell you, I haven't even bought in, though. You say there's a demographic. I really do not... I'm anti-zombie. I just, I'd rather watch a comedy or something that doesn't involve flesh being eaten. You know,
I get it.
Game of Thrones, I'll tell you. That's my genre, but that shit is, you know, just as graphic and cruel. That's the other part, it's cruelty.
Right.
I can't abide by anything like that. I just want to watch, you know, somebody really funny, you know, or something kind of like a puzzle.
And those images stay with you for your life. The stuff that's in your brain. Huh?
Absolutely. I mean, I remember the first time that this dynamic happened to me is watching The Godfather, and that one scene where they jam a knife through the guy's hand, you know, while he's on the table or something there. It was like, yeah. I still feel that. And so I remember as a kid
watching Silver Streak with Gene Wilder and Richard Pryor.
Yeah.
And there was one scene where they were looking out the window and all of a sudden some dead guy appeared in the window, like, hanging upside down.
Oh, right.
And for some reason for me, that was, like, horrific and, like, stayed in my head for a very long time.
Yeah.
But, I mean, compared to that, compared to this stuff today, that was really mild.
Oh, yeah, that was tame. You know, there's no stopping any traumatic image or graphic image from searing the mind of a child. It's just that it's so prevalent now. There's so much graphic violence and sort of willful cruelty to children and women and all that stuff in the society that it's just too much. That you now have to avert. You have to be able to limit the amount of that stuff that comes into your life. I do anyway.
So what do you do when the culture is offensive and it's basically trying to undermine your family? But
well,
at the same time, what if there's arguments to be made for almost like 90% of what's on TV being somehow undermining the values of your family, I would think.
Right, and that's why I say you should change the channel. I mean, I don't think that whatever's on TV right now that I'm not watching can compete with me. I don't think it can compete with me. If I change the channel, and I have a presence in my family's life, whatever's not being shown is not going to compete with me. Now that you can go to school, or they obviously have their own lives and go to the workplace and stuff like that. But once again, I feel like my presence and my influence will have a little more bearing. Mm-hmm. And that's enough for me right now. Like, there's plenty that can undermine my family that doesn't get through the filter, you know, that doesn't come in.
There's plenty that what?
That could potentially come in to undermine my family, but it doesn't.
Right.
It doesn't.
Well, and then there's, what about the idea also that you need to inoculate yourself against the culture by letting some of it in. Like if you totally avoid it, you know, when it does finally, when the floodgates open, you won't have any experience with it. You won't know how to combat it.
Well, that invariably happens. You know, there is a little tidbit that comes in. You know, my daughter's in the first grade, and she's going to talk to somebody who's going to say something, and she's going to have a question or something very foreign to her, and, you know, once you explain it, that's that little bit of tidbit, you know. It's almost like when a pet dies or something, you know, that's you've added that to your experiences, and that is part of life, but you don't necessarily have to dwell on that or focus on that or make it now part of the fabric of your life. Yeah, I don't think you have to strive to yourself. I think if you're open about things that happen to come through and death, that's the thing. You know, that's an interesting, if you just come down to the basic thing about zombies, that they're dead. Dead, dead, dead. And we're alive, and they're trying to eat us. They're dead people versus the living people. And most, I think you can boil down a lot of problems in life and fear that people have is basically a fear of death. And their own mortality. You know, people not prepared for the discussion or for the eventuality. And so there's a lot of things that
also not just their, you know, the end of their body, but the end of their worldview, the end of their
if you're particularly vain, that the feeling that your end of your influence on the world, I guess, or you know, or the end of your
well, which just what yeah. we are just saying right in this moment makes me think, you know, America may be losing its empirehood.
Oh,
you know, and what if some of this is that you don't believe America is losing its empirehood?
America is hotter than it's ever been. And I'll tell you
what,
we are now the number
you're
one.
Not,
huh?
You're the first person I've talked to in a long time who hasn't thought that America's empire was in decline. Go ahead.
Well, you know, define empire. I mean, sure, if you're talking
I will. I mean, like, one aspect is that, like, other countries use the American currency as the standard of stability.
Right, sure.
And, you know, there's very good reason to think that that will not continue.
Well, that's fine. We don't have to be monopolize in order to still dominate.
That's very important. I mean, that's the huh?
Well, the euro, for example, has been great for America. The stability of other currencies doesn't threaten us.
I'm not committed to America's empire declining, but I think that
it's a part of use of the word empire. Maybe geopolitical influence of the United States is not descending; it's on it's ascending.
You should be aware that there's a lot of discussion about that right at this moment, right?
I'm sure there is, but I look at it in a couple of ways. Right now, the United States is the number one exporter of energy and oil, or energy, let's say. Okay. That has a way of influencing the world. A very, very significant...
We're the number one exporter of fuel?
That's right.
You mean ahead of the Middle East and all that?
That's correct.
Ahead of Saudi Arabia and all that?
That's right.
Like our... Well, why are we then importing so much of it?
We are not. It's at historically low levels.
What, our imports?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I do want to get into this at some point.
You don't have to speed that part of the argument. You can look into that and we talk about that later. The other part is our university systems. People are not clamoring to get into Chinese universities, which is probably our next biggest competitor. Meaning that the way that we teach people and the way that people will be taught and then teach others is an American way. It's born and bred in America.
I want to say two things. One is that regardless of, and I will get to whether our empire is declining, but regardless of whether it is or isn't, a lot of people are saying it is, and it's on the national, it's on the national collective unconscious as well as the conscious discussion. So it maybe, I mean, this just occurred to me while we were talking, maybe part of the reason that zombies are so popular is because we're looking at, you know, post world supremacy status for the United States for the first time, and so, you know, the way we tell ourselves that story, in terms of mythology or, you know, popular mythology might be in the form of zombies. That's just a thought. But,
what is the difference between zombies before? How has Walking Dead contributed to the arc of the zombie story? I mean, have they added a new dynamic or dimension? What is going on?
I don't know that they have or not, but I mean, I'm not looking at, my main interest in it is how people are eating it up.
Mm-hmm. And is that the only example of zombieism being eaten up, or is there another kind of, something you can point to that shows that the mainstream right now is sort of being taken by this idea of zombies and zombieism?
Well, we were just talking about some of them, like Abraham Lincoln, Shaun of the Dead. There's also World War Z, You know, the zombie genre is a whole genre in video games. It's a whole genre.
Right, right. Yeah, that's a whole other angle I hadn't thought of. All those, shooting dead zombies coming at you.
And I think, you know, we have to ask, why are we right now, what is it saying to our collective unconscious that we are responding so incredibly, you know, like positively to, if you can call that positively, if we're consuming it, you know, so much. And I'm just coming up with possible explanations. One is that, you know, the conservatives think that the end of the world is imminent, and they always have.
Right.
Right? They've always thought, you know, well, religious people, Christians,
well,
have always thought.
The end times and the rapture is near.
Well, the pilgrims thought we were living in the end times.
Right.
And so what I'm saying is, because I know conservatives who have been predicting it, it's like, oh, it's coming in October, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's coming next year on this date. And I guess, you know, one theory that I've had is that they've when, I don't know, I'm sick of talking about conservatives. I don't even want to talk about them anymore.
Well, they're the bane of any reasonable existence.
But they see...
I don't even need to go there. You don't even have to go to conservatives to try to get to the heart.
Well, because it's crossing the line. I mean, it's not just conservatives watching this zombies. I mean, that's everybody.
I think that demographic is probably male, probably 15 to 28, 26.
Mm-hmm.
That who's really much driving the zombie train.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if you include the video games, that seems to be. I hadn't thought about that portion, but that would highlight a significant demographic, I think. And so, is it that, you know what it is also too? I mean, you know that if you're starting a film company or you're trying to start a production company, the genre that you're supposed to make a lot of money first is a horror film, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it could just be that the ascendancy of the whole horror genre has also lifted the zombie boat, you know what I mean? Like, it just happens that the whole genre has become more popular. And so,
yeah, but that doesn't... Why isn't it, you know, why isn't it killer vegetables, you know? I mean, why isn't it...
Because he's scary about vegetables. Never, well, to me, I hate vegetables.
Oh, okay, but it used to be like... It used to be like Godzilla. There used to be a ton of, well, at least in Japan, you know? Or like giant animals. It used to be... Okay, for a while in this country, it was dinosaurs.
Well, that's an interesting comparison, Japan, because you could do a psychoanalysis of like, it was Japan, Tokyo was always getting destroyed. Like, buildings knocked over. They had this complex where they just thought everything was just going to get stepped on and destroyed all the time by some monster coming out of the sea. So what is that? Right? What is
well,
that?
But, you know, have you noticed they're constantly destroying New York in movies?
Well, now, after 9/11, I think that was it.
Huh?
You know, Nagasaki and Hiroshima were searing events for the Japanese consciousness. And so after that, not only do you have the actual demonstration of mass destruction, but that's coupled with this weird guilt that they felt after, well, not weird guilt, I mean, a guilt that they felt after World War II, you know, this nonviolence, or because they were so violent before, and almost like Tokyo deserved to be destroyed. Hence, Godzilla was never like a bad guy, or I guess not Godzilla, the female, but... you know, it was never like Godzilla meant to harm Tokyo. There's always something about the people that they, you know, they deserve. There's, you know, there's some kind of quality where the radiation, that's what it was. By their own dumbass, you know, radiation poisoning, they created Godzilla, and he comes up and naturally destroys Tokyo. So
right.
That, I think, spoke to the anxieties and the guilt, the, you know, if you want to get Freudian, the guilt that the Japanese felt of their own, you know, place in the world. I don't know, if you want to make the comparison.
Well,
that zombies, like you said, represent this mindless consumption, and people get it, but they don't relate to the zombie. They relate to the people shooting the zombies. So maybe they want to, you know, get away. They want to flee. They want to find a safe place.
They might not relate to the zombies, but I think they think of other people as the zombies. They relate to the experience of being in the world with others who seem somehow to be like zombies.
Right, and want to consume them, want to take their life force,
see,
and turn them into zombies. Isn't that
right.
How it works? You get the bimbo.
Well, and it's very,
with the one, right?
And what? Yeah, that's how it works. But it's a virus.
Uh-huh. Well, not always.
But,
in Return of the Dead, didn't they nuke a graveyard or something like that? Or they put nuclear waste in a graveyard, I think, and that's what happened.
Well, at the end of Return of the Living Dead, there was a nuclear explosion. And I don't know if it came from, like, at the beginning of the movie.
No. I know what it was. There was a toxic spill at a cemetery or maybe at a morgue, I don't know. And that animated certain corpses, and then it was spread like a virus once they started biting people. But I think they decided the solution was to nuke the whole area, not realizing that that would create mass zombieism.
Well, what happened, I think, I don't remember how it started, it was like some toxic chemical that created zombies. So it wasn't a virus in that movie. But at the end of the movie, when they did the nuclear explosion, the rain came.
Yeah.
And then it soaked the nuclear radiation into the ground. I don't actually know how it happened. But the difference between Godzilla and a zombie is very striking. I mean, Godzilla is clearly not human, never was.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's humans against the monster, with Godzilla.
Right.
But now it's the individual against the collective.
Sure.
It's a swarm of zombies. It's a swarm of people.
Although, you know, the individuals never fight by themselves. They always band together and try to find a secure place. Or move together, away.
Right.
And except that one, I Am Legend, he was by himself, but ultimately the narrative was about finding community.
No, but you're absolutely right. And in Walking Dead, the latest episodes have been about, actually everything, it's all about how you keep a group of people together.
Mm-hmm.
And what kind of power structures they develop or you know, leadership of it comes out of it. And lately they've been running into communities that are self-sustaining communities with either like a charismatic crazy leader or like an outlaw villainous leader. And, you know, there are all these questions that come up about how are you leading this group?
Yeah. It sounds like it's sort of an exploration of potential or historic. Well, it can be historic post-apocalyptic, but you can have conditions where, you know, people were in dire conditions and one person took over in the various ways that human beings comported and conformed in those different situations. It can all be explored through The Walking Dead in these little vignettes. But that's a whole other thing that makes me think that this also has something to do with the post-apocalypse, not just zombies. It's that this whole society is broken down. Something has gone wrong. Because, you know, you can have zombies, but where's the National Guard? Let them take care of it. You know what I mean? Why is it that, I got to be running down the street? You also have to have that component to an effective zombie narrative these days. That is that the whole society is broken down. There's nowhere to flee. You've got to, like, find your bit of real estate and protect it.
Yeah, it's like Godzilla was localized.
Yeah.
Like if you weren't in Tokyo, it wasn't a problem.
Right, and they had an air force, you know, get out of the way. They'll take care of it. Here it's like, you better, you know, get your now that I'm thinking, there's been so many influences on the current, like it's been distilled, so many different elements. You have your Mad Max, and without that, you couldn't have the current Walking Dead, the sense of a post-apocalyptic, you know, get your shotgun and you're in control and find fuel or find elements that will help you survive. You got that.
Well, these elements these elements that were in Mad Max were taken from real life too. I mean, there are people who just, I think that's a collective, that's one of the archetypes, you know, the archetypal, images that people have is you go and you are on the land with your gun and your Jeep and your, maybe you'd have a dog and you'd have a woman.
A crossbow.
You know?
And
then, and you need gas. Yeah. You just need enough gas. And then, and then it comes out in the culture.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that Walking Dead really is, I mean, zombies are the device. But the real thing that it is, it's an exploration of like groups and intentional living and like how we get along, you know, when we have all these pressures that we from coming from outside.
You've heard of these survivalists, right? This new thing about survivalism. That's like a thing.
What is it?
Survivalist? I mean, they have their own show now, too, right? Do these different communities that usually like the same, like a charismatic leader or a father figure, arming all of the kids and neighbors, and they're training for an apocalypse or end times or for race riot, or I don't know what it is. But that's, I don't know if that's always been present, but that seems to be on the rise, too.
Well, I mean, you know, there was that show Survivor, too, which I made me think that and Lost. were before The Walking Dead, but it just was some device so that people would have to live in communities. And then there are all the real world things where you have to live in a house together.
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, that's also an extra
rise of this idea that you have different people, you know, the real world as well. Different people, you put them in a stressful situation. Survivor changed it in a bit where you had to have alliances. You know, you had to create and also be somewhat duplicitous sometimes in order for you to be number one.
These are non-family groups. It's like, what happens after the family, maybe? That's part of the thing they're really discussing. Like, in a world that's post-family, how do we get along?
Well, we do live in that world. That's the funny part. I mean, most families are not the atomic family from the 1950s. There's divorcees, there's stepfathers, nieces, grandparents raising children, gay people having adoptees, all kinds of different permutations of family that are way, way different than what the supposed normal family was thought to be. Walking Dead could just be some kind of reaffirmation of that, because I'm certain that you do sympathize with these people who are trying to survive, and that there's got to be good guys, and if they're like, you know, trying to help a black girl and a Chinese guy, and you see that the bonds of family are obviously more than just genetic.
More than what?
Just genetic. You know.
Well, that's
in other words,
exactly what it is. Yeah, that's exactly. I mean, the show has like, you know, the show deals with racism. It's got communities that have people of all races. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they try to, I don't think they've dealt with, homosexuality, and I think they're pretty, but they have dealt with, female empowerment, I think.
Mm-hmm. Sure. You're Terminator types.
Yeah. I don't know if that's the kind of empowerment, you know, that a feminist would be happy
with. Sarah Connor.
Oh?
Sarah Connor,
yeah.
Yeah. She's a badass. She's the prototype.
Yeah.
She's the fucking female badass.
Yeah. She was one of the originals, I guess. But of course, female badasses go way back.
Well, yeah, your modern, like, shotgun slinging badass. But, yeah, you have Amazons and...
But there were women with guns, though, like in the black and white movies. But they just didn't, like, have a big body count usually. But they, yeah, anyway, I don't want to get into that.
Yeah, but they were also hypersexualized. They really weren't, like, three-dimensional.
Right.
Like, Sarah Connor was a three-dimensional, well portrayed by What's-Her-Face, you know, well-written, and it gave you kind of, like, this idea that she's a, you know, she's a survivor, scrapper.
So I think that what we're looking at in when we're looking at these zombie movies is, you know, you have a choice. You are either part of this anarchy, which is what zombies represent, in a way,
Do zombies choose to be zombies?
No. I mean, I think that unconsciously the viewer is like, it's not a choice. I mean, it's not presented as a choice.
Well,
it's like you have to.
It's even a choice. It seems more like an anxiety, like something you don't. You're fleeing. You're running away
right.
from this.
Well,
you don't want to happen to you.
But what I'm really looking for is what's the message here? I mean, the message is, you know, you have to learn to get along with the people that you're trapped in this house with, you know, because outside is the kind of people that you really cannot get along with.
Mm-hmm.
You know it. There's people who can get along with each other, but then there's also people who are just there to eat your brain.
Right. Well, it's an external threat that causes you to have to be pragmatic and think about more than just yourself.
It's an external threat, but it's not just the same as every external threat. It's a zombie, and that's what I'm. You know, I'm saying why now? Why zombies?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think for all those reasons, you know, especially
I think
the disincorporated the different dispossessed body, sort of mindlessly consuming.
Especially the. The what?
Oh, what about the Borg? Remember the Borg?
Oh, the Borg, but they didn't take off. It's not like our culture. Our culture could be full of cyborgs right now.
They were like cyborg zombies, right?
They were, but that was like one show.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, they were like, well, maybe you're right. But they were very different from zombies.
Yeah, they didn't want to eat anybody, although they did want to take your body. I mean, they did want to, they ultimately would take your body and mutilated, but that was for dominance, for the geopolitical dominance, which may be at the time, you know, the Russians, Chinese were, you know, they say like the Klingons represented the Russians back in the day.
I realize that was our enemy, but I find it hard to believe that the Klingons weren't somehow Middle Eastern.
Well, they look Mexican, dude. I didn't, you know, the haircuts and the goatees and all that stuff, it kind of looked like they were Hispanic, to be honest. But, like, dark Hispanic. They were meant to represent the Russian Empire, though, and the Romulans were the Chinese.
Huh.
My understanding of Gene Roddenberry-isms.
I haven't really... I haven't done
According
that research.
To Roddenberryology.
He said that?
Yep.
He said that?
Yep.
All right.
Look it up.
I'm going to just take your word for it this time.
it wasn't meant to be, I think, reflective of who the Russian people were. I think they were meant to show the geopolitical threat if the Enterprise was the United States, the kind of thing that they were facing at the time, which was a warlike empire that wanted to take over. No, go ahead.
But it just occurred to me for the first time the word Enterprise, in like, you know, a capitalist economy.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, it never
technically, it does mean any kind of adventure or venture that you go on to. But America is that. It was kind of like, we're going to sail across this big thing and make an America. And then once we're here, we're going to try this thing out called democracy. And then we're going to do this crazy thing and try to separate ourselves from King, you know, it's just a constant enterprise over here. That's the next step of zombieism. Like, zombies cash it, like, they don't want brains, they want some bucks. It's zombie bling. You know what I mean?
Zombie. You mean like they're going to start, like, taking your money, zombies?
They're going to crave, you know, accoutrement. Zombling.
Zombling.
Mm-hmm.
That's good, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, zombies with nice rings, and maybe specific body parts will, you know, give you status if you wear them. You know, if you have somebody's ear would make you put that, like, on your lapel, and all of a sudden you're king of the zombies.
I don't know, man. I've thought about that, like, what's the evolution of zombies going to be? Will there be a sentient zombie? Because I kept waiting for that to happen in Walking Dead. You know, wouldn't that be the next thing, you know? But
why not?
I don't know, but vampires have not really evolved. They have a little. They have a little.
Sure,
but
they have. I mean, did you see the Lincoln vampire one? I mean, they have, like, they're aligning themselves with certain politicians. You know what I mean? Or, you know, if you look at the, what's that series, the werewolf versus vampire thing? That's, like, societies and levels, and then you have, God, what's that other one, Blade? That was a whole thing where you have hybrids, and the whole thing is really...
Isn't that just, like, the vampire becoming more human, in a way? Like,
yes,
more humanized?
Yes, absolutely.
So how do you do that with a zombie?
Well, you do the same thing, but you have to give them consciousness, I guess. Which would upset the whole premise, I guess.
Wait
a minute, dude. I just saw a preview of a film or maybe a TV show or something where a girl is dating a zombie or...
What?
Yeah, like this...
There's a commercial where a zombie tries to get insurance.
Right, there's that. I've seen that. And he's talking and he's like a zombie. He's trying to deny his zombies. But this one is actually a film, I think, about a guy who becomes a zombie, but he still kind of loves the girl, so he doesn't try to eat her brains, but, you know, he's working on becoming a better person. Like, seriously, I just saw a preview like this where this may be your next missing link. You have to go...
Well, that's what happened...
The premise of this movie is...
That's what happened with vampires when, you know, they... I mean, that's what Twilight is. You know, he's a vampire, but he loves this girl.
Yeah, I don't think you can avoid the evolution of the zombie.
The same thing that happened to vampires is going to happen to zombies. But how can you be an attractive zombie?
Because you've got a good heart.
So this is going to finally help us go past the superficial, skin deep.
Don't go crazy. I don't think the whole culture is going to be enlightened because zombies have personalities that other people can withstand. Or
I'm always looking for the way out.
For the hook.
I'm always looking for the, you know, like, finally we will be, you know.
Well, I agree. I think we are in a, like I said at the beginning, a progressively upward spiral. So there are small increments that move our society forward to becoming more enlightened.
Yeah.
And maybe the enlightenment of the zombie will be one of those stepping stones. Where actually the zombie is the hero. And the bad guy is, you know, the living person trying to shoot his head off.
Right. I mean, that has happened in many vampire movies, so maybe that will be the evolution of the zombie genre.
Cowboys and
Indians. Well, you said it here on Cult Studs, and we have it recorded for now. We can, 10 years later, we'll see whether that happened.
That's right. We can refer back to our prognostications.
And also whether the American Empire has declined.
Well, again, it depends on what you mean by empire. I mean,
But that's a different show.
iPhones from Hong Kong, you know what I mean? Like, Google was not made in Sri Lanka or Scandinavia.
But you're looking at the present, you know, to make your point, and all of the arguments about the decline are based on the trajectory, not on the current balance of power.
Right. Well, again, the trajectory for our oil production and energy production is higher than it's been. I don't see our trajectory in terms of our culture and education having changed much. People are still trying to get into the United States to get a degree here in Nebraska.
Yeah, but you're looking at the present. But
yeah,
you have to look at the rate of change.
Wherever it was in 1950, it's either on par or higher. Because you have
okay, if the two points on your graph are the 1950s and now.
Well, wherever. I'm just going as back as the 50s.
Instead of going there, try looking at the relationship between, look at China. Look at their graph.
China's got 1 billion hungry people. I would not put like China up on some kind of stable, long-term, middle-class empire. You know, that's not empire. That is not the same on par with the kind of influence that the United States or England or Spain had in their respective eras. You know, China is not.
I think it is very interesting.
He's been able to permeate, but not.
I think that it is very interesting that at the end of a conversation about zombies and what they represent, we are talking about China and the United States. China having 1 billion people, you know, it's got 1 billion people.
But the reason is because at the end of the zombie conversation, you brought up the decline of the American Empire.
All right, I brought it up. All right.
Point B. So maybe there is something, you know, to glean from that. There is obviously a relationship in your mind between the zombie zeitgeist and the decline of the American Empire.
Well, there could be. I mean, but I also think that there's a pretty strong argument right now. If you were to look at the arguments, I mean, or what points people are making in every field, they are talking about it not being a question of if, but when with China. When will their economy surpass the United States? It's really not in doubt. I don't think that there's any doubt about this, that China will become.
The economy has been growing like at 3.7% prior to 2011 or 12. I think last year they were growing at 1.6%, and they're on actually a downward growth. So I get China being like, you know, top notch, but like I said, nobody is going to China trying to get a degree out of any of their universities.
You're talking again about the present. You're not talking about the rate of change.
Yes, I am talking about the rate of change because
you're saying nobody's going to China for, huh?
We have more people trying to get into the United States than we did yesterday or the day before that or the day before that. Or going
That's
back to whatever point you want to start your...
No, I starting, here's what it is. You
Where
look
you
at, you look at, if your index of how, of the strength of the United States Empire is how many immigrants are coming to this country right now.
No, that's one rivulet, like I was saying.
All right, well, but that's the one that we're talking about right now. I mean, if that is one of the,
Okay, yeah.
If that's a data point that you want to look at, then you have to say, look at the trends that are going on. Look what most people are predicting is going to happen with the world economy and where it's going to be centralized. You have to, I would think, say that that's going to change. The immigration patterns are going to change. Based on where the economies have the most jobs available.
Okay, but they haven't changed, is my point. They have
yeah,
not
but
changed.
They've gotten better.
There's more Saint, Pakistanis, more
but we're not talking about
more
but we're talking
to get into the United States.
We're talking about not the past or the present, but the future.
You're saying into the future, these numbers are going to start to decline.
I'm saying that based on the fact
now, but they're going to experience a point where they'll start to dip again. Or for
wow, I do not think that I'm even close to being in the minority on this argument that China's economy is expected to surpass the United States. I don't know what you're reading.
See, that's interesting because you're focusing solely on one data point, and that's their economy. You have to think this holistically. China is not healthy. They had to shut down a whole city the other day because nobody could breathe outside. You tell me how that data point is 20 years.
No, look, I'm not trying to say China will necessarily replace the United States,
but
am saying that if you look
other trajectories into the future, to
well, I am. I actually am. I am so far from being.
You're looking at America's future, but you're
focusing
on China's present.
Not at all. No, let's talk about India and Brazil. Would you like to?
India. Okay. How many Indian women are judges, would you say? What percentage?
What percentage of Indian women are judges? Without getting into your cross-examination here,
my point is that India is so far behind in equal rights, which means they're so far behind in productivity. Because that's what it translates into. You have no women in your workplace, then you have no.
But,
you're always in the secondary economy.
But
so
what
I
happened?
I want to hear about India being on an ascendancy until they figure
out
democracy.
You don't want to hear about India being on the ascendancy. But what happens when India's economy changes? You know their society
for their 1%. And meanwhile, a billion people are starving. You think that's good for their democracy?
You've got this. Wow, you've got this picture of the world in which nothing changes.
On the contrary, I am saying that they're way behind. We've done a lot of our homework, and we can go to reset. They need to work on their fundamentals. China, India, Brazil, they round up miners and kill them to get rid of, you know, this poor class in Brazil.
Look at the United States. Look at the United States 150 years ago. And using your same cultural analysis, tell me that United States deserves to become a superpower.
Deserves? Well, whether they deserved it or not, they did. First of all, they went to the moon. Okay.
But you're talking about a country where little kids were. You're talking. No, that's my second of all when I'm raising a point. Okay, go ahead and tell me your second of all if you want.
Right. They figured out the civil rights thing, at least on paper. Okay. No other country really figured that out, kind of like we did. We granted voting rights. We enforced that.
But I don't know if you're recognizing the fact that these countries are basically where the United States was in the past because of of how developed they are.
Aren't we? We're comparing future trajectories, aren't we? And if you're starting way past here. If you're saying they're 150 years back, then I don't see how they surpass us anytime soon.
Here's your answer, and I'm giving you the answer. The answer is what used to be 100 years is now 20.
Okay, so it's accelerated. I get it. But the amount of time that they need to get to where they need to go is not enough time to overpass us anytime soon. China.
Well, what define soon. I mean, maybe that's the whole problem with this conversation. Maybe we're
this century.
We have a different idea of when it's going to happen. I think by the end of this century, I think we might have, we might all be like unrecognizable. To say that you can predict that the United States will still be the superpower at the end of the century is mind blowing.
I'm saying we won't be surpassed. I'm not saying we'd be
You know what? I like that. I like that idea.
Figure out its problems.
I like the idea that, I mean, and I've heard that too. I've heard that, there are problems we're not considering when we predict that China will be the global superpower. I'm happy with the idea that it won't, there won't be any more superpowers. I like that.
Well, so I think that might be a little, I just don't think that you can say there won't be a country that will be influencing the rest of the world as much as we do. Because I think through our history.
Okay, so put what you just said together, and you're saying that that there will be a superpower, and it won't be anybody but us.
I'm just saying it won't be an economic necessarily or military superpower, but there will be a cultural superpower, and that will be the United States. And that's because
let's export
our culture at a rate more significant than any other country.
Again, you're talking about the present. You're talking about the present,
yeah.
And not the future.
Well, India is coming up. Bollywood is coming up, but it's not. I don't see it surpassing Hollywood anytime soon.
Yeah. Well,
and again,
but Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
Hollywood. If you look at the data, Hollywood is leaving Hollywood, and once it does, why should it stay in the United States?
Well, Hollywood, I think, can be an umbrella term for American entertainment. It doesn't have to be made in Hollywood. Okay. It's American
well,
values
it made,
made with.
I mean,
with
as much as any, as much as any industry, the entertainment industry, it's free to go.
You what?
The entertainment industry, you know, it's not like there's something unique to the United States that keeps it here.
Well, you're talking about maybe production, like. Well, like keeping it here, what I'm saying is the values, United States values get exported through film, music, television, and many other forms of art at a significantly deeper and higher and faster rate than the cultures through those mediums of any other country. I can't think of, maybe, you know.
It has.
No, I
can't
think
of, and it continues. But I don't see. I can't. I don't know why you. What?
Like, who are you talking about? I don't.
When I say what?
You mean that? When you're
said
saying
what? I don't think you.
Some other country has, or were you agreeing with me?
I don't know what
you
think I said, but I don't think you.
When I say that there's no comparison by any other country to how the United States has been able to export its culture to its various media. I mean, I can't think of maybe England. I don't know, but through their
no,
music.
I didn't disagree with you with that. I said that you're talking about the past and the way it is now, but I think if you look at, you know, I don't think
yeah,
it's going to continue.
Dude, you keep wanting to ignore the past, like it has no, like everything's in a vacuum. That's where the trajectory, we're starting way high up on our trajectory. People have to come up to meet us. That's from the past. You can't ignore the current data point sitting on the graph on where the X and the Y is. Because it started back there, you know. That
you know what? If you were, if here's what I think is what this isn't an exact analogy, but I really it's begging to be said. If you jump off a cliff halfway down, you can say that you're halfway up if you just look at where you are.
But you're never going to go up again. That's not a good analogy because
but if you're not looking at your trajectory,
You're saying that the only
if you're not looking at the if you're not looking at the direction in which that you're going in, you're just looking at where you're at. You might think that you're up when really you're falling.
Well, you're up in comparison, and if falling last means you win, then we're winning. I mean,
okay,
now you're just
trying to win this point, and I.
No, again,
if it means that much to you, you can have it.
No, I think you're trying to describe other countries as being threatening, or at least, that our decline is due to the rise of these other countries. I don't know, but I just don't agree, first of all, with that.
Oh well, I'd like to take issue with the word threatening. Because I don't want to feel threatened. I think that if the United States ends up like the other former superpowers, like the United, like England or Japan, or even like Germany, I think that would be fine. And I look forward to that, actually, when the United States is not the global superpower. I don't think the world needs a global superpower.
Well, one day, hopefully, it will be like that, you know, when other countries such as England can diversify their popularities with you know, various ethnic and socioeconomic groups, you know, and from A to B, you know, and Zaire can do it too. But right now, you know, England is a classist society, and, you know, they're very militaristic like us. I don't see them dominating any kind of cultural or...
What are you responding to? What do you think I just said about England?
Well, no, other countries, not just England. I forget, what was your point?
My point was that you said, like, you mentioned the word threatening, like, as if it's threatening that the United States is going to lose its empire, but to me it's not threatening at all. I think the United States needs to have a more cosmopolitan, you know, place.
Well, I think that was my point. Eventually we'd like to get to a place where all countries act in the same way so that there is no dominant power. But I think that that's not the case, that there are obvious differences between...
Well, but again, you're talking about the present. You're not talking about the trajectory.
Well, the present indicates that the near future will continue to be very much like the present until...
Well,
I think that's why
you know,
I'm talking about the present. I'm not talking about the future because right now the future is indicated by the present. You know, I think other countries are striving.
What about my brilliant example of falling off a cliff and thinking that you're standing in midair?
I don't understand that analogy. Why is
okay? There's an 80-foot cliff,
and also it's linear. You're thinking of it in a very linear, like one direction down, and only going in one.
Well, it's a simplification to make a point. It's an analogy that's simplified.
Yeah. That's why I don't think it fits, because you can go in many directions. You can go back up. You can be midway. You can actually stall out in the middle and then go back up again. I don't think that's why the analogy
works. Fine. But my point was that, you know, you're trying to say, look at us, we're on top of the world. What makes you think that's going to change? And just the fact that we're on top of the world is not in itself evidence that it's not going to change.
And, you know, look at it this way. The Justice League has all these great heroes on it, right? But it's like Superman is still kind of the boss of all the other ones, in a way. He's still, like, he's got the...
Yeah, the old Justice League, but when we still had that view of America, you would never have that set up today.
Well, you know, Superman is still kind of the main guy everybody goes to.
I don't know. I haven't seen the latest Superman movie. Is he, like, exactly that way now still? Or
yeah,
does he have, like...
He's always kind of that way. He's, like, got the name. Everybody knows Superman. Everybody knows who Martian Manhunter is or Hawkgirl. You know what I mean? Like, if you need a go-to guy, it's always Superman. And I think, in a way, the United States is like, we've had the longest stable democracy. We've kind of been through the economies. We've done the technology thing. People are always going to look at us and say, hey, you know, what do you think? What's going on? We're here now. You've been there. And that's why looking at the past and understanding that as part of the being woven into our future, that we will always get that recognition.
I think England has that position that you're describing. Basically, what you're saying is
they've never had an economy like ours.
Well, they were the only superpower for a while, and so, you know, that's pretty close.
Nobody cares back then. Nobody cared.
I'm sorry, that's an irresponsible thing to say.
I just don't think that it's had the same influence, you know, pound for pound. England did not have the same global influence that the United States currently enjoys. Dominated, they, you know, Shakespeare, the English language, all that, you know, they... Really, but, you know, it just doesn't...
I did not realize you were this patriotic. I did not know that.
You know, at its core, it's the Democratic Revolution that really puts America apart. That is...
Well, America's Democratic Revolution comes largely from England.
Well, yeah, but they didn't do it. That's the thing. They didn't do it.
Without England's laying the framework for it, it wouldn't have happened.
Well, yeah, certainly we spoke English when it happened. But
it's not just that we spoke the same language. All of the people who created the democracy in America were influenced by very specific ideas from England, that from English philosophers and English government.
Well, and the Greeks and the Romans as well. You know, they were classic.
Well, it passed through England, and then so they developed it. England developed it. You are so committed to, like, diminishing England relative to the United States, or, like, you know, I mean,
well, I don't know.
Why does jingoism?
Yeah, it's tough, you know. The fuel system, the irrigation, no, they contributed. I've got no problem with England.
Fuel?
Huh?
Did you say fuel and irrigation? Oh, school. Yeah. Did you say fuel or school?
No, feudalism.
Oh, yeah. Did you hear about, like, I mean, do you understand that the founding fathers and all those people gave very clear credit to the people who influenced them and made their views possible, and they were English?
Okay. Who were they?
Well, John Locke is brought up pretty often in that.
The economist, right?
No, he's a philosopher. I don't know if he's an economist. But, I think there probably were. But, the Magna Carta is considered very important to the ideas of the Constitution?
Sure.
But, I mean, in that way, the United States and Superman can influence other cultures in the future. We don't have to think of it as, like, you know, dying or a bad thing.
Well, I just think it's all in flux. It's not. Nobody. Here's a good way to put it. Nobody will ever have our past. That's what we bring to the table.
No, but you know, okay, the way that the United States, like you were saying, is bigger than England. When there are more people in the world and our technology gets stronger, then whatever empire comes is going to be stronger than the empires that existed when there were fewer people and the technology wasn't advanced. So if the technology of the future is even stronger and there are even more people in the world, any empire, any superpower is going to be that much stronger because of it. It should, if this trend progresses, which it won't necessarily, but if it did, you know, there should be a superpower which dwarfs the United States or is bigger than the United States in the same way that the United States is bigger than England's empire.
Hmm. But what happened when, right after World War II, and Stalin and Roosevelt and what's his name? Sat down. The English guy.
Churchill.
And everybody was. Yeah, Churchill.
Hey, how come you forget the name? How come you forget the name of the English guy?
I knew you were going to say that. I don't know why. But
you're like anti. You're anti Anglo.
Colonial?
No, English.
I'm an Anglo Nixon.
What?
You're an Anglophobe.
You're an Anglophobe. Anglophobe.
Big Shakespeare fan. I don't think that's so. Some of my best friends are English. Anyway, what was I saying?
When they sat down, Lenin, Stalin, and Churchill.
Oh yeah, everybody was on par. Everybody had the same. Everybody had the same place. We all started at the same place, but somehow Russia ended up all effed up. You know, there's something different. Just because you have the technology and the money. And the power of the land.
But we know why Russia.
Sure, a dominance.
Yeah.
And a stronger.
So what's your point? So what is your point? Like, can you?
You're saying that whatever next empire comes around will be more stronger or more influential because of the technology.
Not necessarily. But
okay,
but well, I mean, the United States. The United States is a superpower at a time when globalization is happening and you know. The world is being markets are being opened up more than they were in the time of England's, you know, being a superpower.
Yeah, they're doing it on models based on American models, doing it through technology coming from Silicon Valley, emulating, you know, the situation who's on, TV or whatever his name was, the New Jersey guy, or DMX or, Snoop Dogg. Yeah, these things are emerging, but they're all emerging in ways that look a whole lot like us. You know? That's the power that I'm talking about, the soft power of our culture and our influence.
Well, I think you will find that, and this is a very interesting point about culture and power. I think you may find, like, if you look at England's ascendancy, when was Shakespeare? Shakespeare was at the time of England's ascendancy. The power of a culture and the power of its, you know, of the society in general, I think, are pretty closely paralleled when you look at history.
Well, we've had a pretty good, you know, streak of, you know, best hits, like greatest hits. So I think...
So did England. So did England.
Then our so did England. Has been pretty consistent, our dominance.
So was England. And so was Rome. And so was Japan for a while. Japan was doing pretty well, too.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Well, I mean, my point...
South Korea did have Psy, Gangnam Style, was the first, Korean hit, top 40. Maybe we're
Korea is looking pretty good.
Korean
right
world
now.
Dominance. You know? Bollywood. Who knows?
Well, but, I mean, when you look at Korea, Korea is,
You know what's wrong with Korea?
It's what's wrong?
Korean. Well, you can't get any Armenian food in Korea. Can't go see a Broadway play, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Can't catch a basketball game, probably, mm-hmm. on the terms that you want to catch it. That's the thing about America. We got everything, man. Whatever you want, come to America. You go to Korea, you can get a bunch of Koreans. Here, there's a lot of white people here, but there's a whole lot of other stuff, too.
Well, I think that is one of our strengths.
Azerbaijan. We got people from Azerbaijan. Come on.
Yeah.
And the Yucatan.
That's true.
China's going to compete with that? Please. England? No. Can't get a taco in England.
Well, you know,
that is the point. You cannot get a decent taco in England.
What'd you say?
You cannot get a decent taco in England.
I think that as we're sort of jettisoning our old myth of America, because the ideal of, like, this being the land of democracy has sort of been discredited, I think that the idea that this is the land of diversity may come to take its place.
Hmm.
And I think a myth is really important, you know, in terms of...
I don't think I buy your premise, and I'll tell you why.
Which part?
The part that... have you ever heard of President Mitt Romney?
No.
Me neither. He doesn't exist because he lost the election.
I can't believe I walked right into that one.
Mm-hmm. Barack Obama was reelected. And with an array of money, forces, dynamics, even historical dynamics against him. But the people who wanted him to win voted, and they voted more than the other side. I don't buy into this premise that somehow our democracy, maybe on the state and local level, it needs a little more work.
Oh, no. Stop. I was not referring to when was it, the 2012 election? I was not referring to that when I talked about the idea of our democracy as being discredited. I was referring to the fact that you cannot talk about United States as being the land of the free to a certain type of intellectual in this country, or, you know, and it's pretty broad, without them laughing in your face. You know, because this, you know, we used to talk about this being a land of the free, but you can't, and like from the times of the founding fathers, and we just can't really get away with that.
Well, you want to talk trajectories. Back then, they actually owned people, and like those people couldn't say.
Well, that's you're
nowadays,
basically talking about what I'm talking about. You can't. But the idea of America as being the land of the free came about when people owned people and were slaughtering the Indians. You know,
mm-hmm.
The whole land of the free thing was, you know, because according to our current understanding, now that we think of different colored people as also being people, it's no longer really credible that this has been the land of the free. We are becoming freer, but that story of America is no longer valid. And in order to have some story of ourselves we can still believe in, we need to go with the Obama is president one.
Well, you know what? No, not everybody believed that story to begin with, and especially, I'm sure, the slaves, George Washington slaves. I don't think they were like, yeah, this is land free, love it.
Enough people believed it that it was basically like the story of America. It was Superman's motto.
Well, those were two Jews who created Superman who were living, you know, the memory of World War II. And so they came up with a super guy who could basically project American values onto the world.
Yeah, I'm saying they believed that back then. Nobody believes that anymore, except for right-wingers.
That was a very realistic context. The Americans had just won World War II through military might, through strength. And so that context, I think, influenced the creation of that particular myth.
Sure, but the people don't believe this. People,
living document. It's not something
the people,
that is static.
Oh, you're a constitutionalist.
No, I'm saying it's not a static constant. I'm actually not a constitutionalist. I believe.
Oh, right. Okay.
That it's not a static.
But the people.
It's similarly, it's not a static concept.
Okay, fine. But the people who say that we are making other countries safe for democracy when we invade them are not taken seriously among the most intelligent people in this country anymore, and they are definitely...
You had rallies, millions of people rally all over this country when George Bush tried to say that. That's the height of democracy. People gathering in the public to say...
Again, I think you are failing to look
democracy.
At the trajectory. That was the death... rattle of that belief that has been completely discredited by him.
Wait, by who?
You're giving George Bush as an example of the belief that America is fighting to make the world safe for democracy.
George Bush. I'm using the protest against George Bush as an example. The millions of people who came out in democratic fashion and said, no, I don't believe that you can bring democracy at the point
right.
of the time.
Oh, well, then you're making my point. Then you're making my point, which is that people won't believe
in democracy. My point is that's democracy. You think that happens in Iraq? You think that happens in North Korea, where people come out and speak their views?
I think it happens all throughout the world.
Well, yeah, you do have mass rallies, and those
not
are
just in America.
Well, I agree, and I think they're all healthy signs of a democracy at play.
Can we sort of retrace our steps or just to crystallize what it is that you think we're disagreeing about?
I think you're saying that, well, here's what you've said. You've said that the myth of American democracy is on its decline. My point is that there are, first of all, people who never held that belief in this country, have never felt that that's an American truth. In fact, it's a paradox. And as I said, especially George Washington's slave. My other point is that the current protest against people who would say something like democracy can be brought once we invade a country, the way that millions of people in this country rallied and said, no, actually, we don't agree with you. They were expressing their democratic, it's a sign of a healthy democratic state, that people are not oppressed or pressured or intimidated to hold a particular political view, that instead of a diminished democracy, we have expanded the concept of democracy. Back then it was a narrow thing, now it's a very wide thing. And to me, that does not indicate a destruction of myth. It's just a living evolution of that myth.
I would say that a lot of what you describe...
Respond directly. You were saying in your point. How did
all
that
I
really
said was...
Point? Now I'm telling you... That
all
you
I said
that
was...
Make or break the point.
Can I just bring up a point of order? All I said was, I would say, and you interrupted me to tell me to respond to you.
Yeah, I don't, because I knew where you were going with that. It wasn't in a direct response to what I just said.
Okay, then what is it what is the thing that you're allowing me to say again?
No, I want you to respond directly to that point. You were saying that the myth of democracy was dying or dead. Any intellectual would laugh at you if you said that something about democracy in the United States, and I just gave you two examples of why that premise I don't think is accurate and not correct.
You gave me two examples. And they were the protests against George Bush and what else?
Well, that there's healthy democracy, healthy democratic protests in the United States, and that this myth never really existed for a large segment of the population. That
it, okay, it I will. Really I will. Yeah. What? You ready?
Yeah.
Okay. Washington slaves and other slaves and other victims of United States were not really part of the national conversation that was being had. So to say that Washington slaves didn't believe that the United States was really free, they weren't part of the national conversation anyway.
So are you only talking then about this so-called intellectual sitting somewhere in a coffee house, and only that guy can comment on whether the myth is alive or dead?
No.
Because that's what it sounds like you're saying in George Washington's time, that only the intellectuals can talk about whether or not they believe there was American freedom. I'm talking about the whole society, the underclass, the untouchables, everybody.
No, I'm not. My turn?
Yep.
I am not saying that only, when I say the national discussion of George Washington's time, I'm not only talking about intellectuals. I am talking about everybody who was really participating in America's idea of itself, which could be called, you know, unified in some way. And that did not include slaves or Native Americans or women, usually, except for a few exceptions. Among the people that were left, they believed America was the land of the free and that they had a real democracy. And now the national discussion and you know, what makes America's idea of itself has expanded to include people whose ancestors were victims of the United States. And so, and people have come to understand that more. And so this whole image of the United States as being somehow exceptional, and it's called American exceptionalism, you know, that America is actually a force for good in the world, is not really flying like it used to. And I think that's just clear. And I think, but I do believe that, and I think that we are coming up with a new story of ourselves to replace it, which is the land of, you know, the Statue of Liberty one. You know, we're I think that's coming up to replace the old one, which was that, you know, there's something inherent about the United States. And there might be. I mean, there is. America was a huge example for the rest of the world, and that's what the Statue of Liberty symbolizes.
Yeah.
But we're having to change our narrative. It's changing.
Right. Well, again, I'll have to go back to my very, I'm sure, tedious data points. But have you ever heard of the Japanese debt ceiling?
No.
Or the Australian debt ceiling? Or the Canadian debt ceiling?
But because nobody because I haven't
cares
heard of
about
it.
Their debt ceiling. Our debt ceiling is the most important fucking thing on this planet.
But you're talking about the president again.
That's one.
You're talking about the president. Wait, what point are you making by saying that?
Just that the status of our economy will continue to influence the globe. Globe's economy. Just on the economy.
How does the fact that it is currently influencing the world's economy, which is the only point that you just made, how does that go to show that it will continue to?
It's just, I mean, what do you want, how far ahead do you want to debate? I mean, in the next 10 years, are you saying, like, you're saying next year it won't be an influence? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm not. I said, okay, the last thing I said was
10 years it won't be an influence.
Well, the one thing that I said that relates to time.
I'm asking you, what is your time?
I am asking your question. What are you trying to do? Are you trying to tell me that I have to answer yes or no?
Well, that'd be nice. You can't. It's a simple question.
No, but you can't do that. You can't do that in an honest debate. You can't demand that somebody answer.
I'm just trying to build an understanding of where your debate is.
I'm answering your question. I really am. I'm just not doing it within the parameters that you're the narrow parameters that you're willing to allow me to have. I'm not. I'm going to answer your question.
Tell me how long do you think that's going to last? And I'm just asking. Well,
I am answering your question. You don't like my answer.
I want to hear it. I'd love to hear it.
Earlier in the conversation, I said that what used to be 100 years or 150 is now 20. It might be, you know, now that I'm thinking about it, let's say 50 years. If we're both alive in 50 years, we can see. I believe that in 50 years, America will become like the India, like the England of today.
Okay, 2063. We're talking about 2063.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's pure conjecture. There's nothing you can point to right now that can tell me that China, Brazil, India, whatever country you want to talk about, is going to be, first of all, in a similar place that we are. Nor do I see any of those countries being on par with us.
Of course there are things I can point to.
Institutions.
Of course there are. Of course there are. Of course there are.
What data points are you looking at to see that trajectory into the future?
Well, you know what? There's this big word, outsourcing.
Okay.
And I believe it means something.
The future of the world is outsourcing, and that's going to turn the tide, the economic tide.
Well, the conditions of the world are such that when somebody does something cheaply anywhere in the world, you know, the companies are ready to go and take advantage of it. And so you're not going to be able to preserve our way of life without raising the way of life of the rest of the world.
Okay, so basically you're saying, you're not saying that the rest of the world is coming up. You're just saying we're getting down to where Guam is.
No, I'm saying it's going to be an equilibrium.
Right. But you keep talking about decline. Maybe we have to identify what that means. What does decline mean? Are we fighting zombies? Or you're just saying people can't afford to buy two Lexuses? What is decline?
Yeah, it's the two Lexuses one.
Okay. So you're saying that our standard of life is on a downward spiral, downward trajectory, if I understand.
Well, right now, and I'm going to answer you without saying yes or no. I hope you can allow me to do that. But right now,
if you want to be nuanced.
Thank you. Right now, when you just look at the carbon and the carbon dioxide output of Americans, mm-hmm. that's one statistic I happen to know.
Okay.
That we... Even though we are
that has sharply declined in California, hasn't it?
Well, but it's about consumption overall. It's not. That's just an indicator of our consumption levels. We consume 20% of the world's resources, and we are 4% of its population. Now, is it such a bad thing if we just consume the amount of the resources that we actually, you know, are proportional to?
I still don't hear anything in there about, you know, us eating rats to survive. I just don't, what is the decline?
Good, good. I don't know why I should have to say anything about that.
Well, what is the decline then? You're just saying we consume too much more. It's unequal amount we consume and it's not sustainable. And so then what?
No, I'm not saying this is, I'm saying it's going to happen and I'm saying I'm not too bothered by it because of how unequal it is right now. I'm saying that since companies and capital are so free to go wherever they want, what we're going to see is where you have these, you know, unequal standards of living spread out over a society like ours, that's going to start to change or could, you know, as these resources...
I don't understand where the decline is, though, like that puts us to a place where... We're sort of impoverished, I guess, or what is the decline?
No, well, if you call it impoverished, if we are 4% of the population and we start consuming 4% of the world's resources instead of 20%, that's going to be a decline.
Okay, that's a decline. Good decline. I didn't know we were talking about good declines. I thought we were talking about negative declines, like
no, a decline is just mean,
or you know, superpowery type things.
Well, if we're only consuming 4%,
actually good decline, like
yeah, if you're only consuming 12
decline.
Yeah, well, now I'm telling you, we are talking about a good decline. It, but you can't stay a superpower and without consuming more than your share. I mean, part of the reason why you're a superpower is because you're getting the most.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of the trajectory, I mean, you think we're going to not become a superpower because we, in the future, will be consuming less, and it's not. It's by definition impossible to be a superpower unless you're over-consuming.
I don't think, well, I mean, that's one cross-section of a very, of a thing that is three-dimensional. I mean,
yeah, I think there are other dimensions. There's the cultural, the soft power. I keep coming back to that. Like, that stuff doesn't go away
if you look at
out of uranium, you know?
If you look at history, you'll see that the soft power and the hard power pretty much go together in every case.
Well, I don't know. I mean,
because
Greece
countries
really
in
a whole lot
countries
of power now, but they influence significantly how we shape our world. You know.
No, but when they did influence how we shaped our world, they were the hard power leaders.
Well,
I mean, you're making an example in support of my argument. You're making my point.
It was more their philosophical power. They didn't have. I mean, they were struggling against other nations.
No, they were the world power. Greece was the world power at the time of their philosophers being, because when you're the world power, your culture is exported everywhere.
Mm-hmm. No, you're right. During Alexander and Macedonia and all that take over, at that point in time, obviously, they were the dominant power. But it strikes me that their philosophy was somewhat divorced, I guess, from their military might.
It always is, isn't it? I mean, it has nothing. It's like man and woman. It's like the man bring home the bacon and the woman fries it up in the pan.
Oh, no, I mean the period of its height, the height of the Greek philosophy.
What was its philosophy and how was it
current? With,
how does it not?
I don't know. It came after Alexander the Greek? And when Greece
No, I think the reason we know about the Greeks and that they had such great philosophers and everything was because they were an empire. Let me say this. I knew you were going to interrupt me. Or they had an empire because their culture set the stage for them having it. And that might be the argument that you make.
It had to do with the Romans letting it go. You know, the Romans. If the Romans were like, you know what, fuck these Greeks, let's bury all their shit, then you would not have heard about Greece. But the idea that...
The Romans needed the Greeks to, like, because basically, the Romans to the Greeks...
Stories.
No, here's something good. No, but the Romans to the Greeks... Here's an analogy. Okay, here's
the math formula.
You know the SAT?
Yeah.
Okay, Romans are to Greeks as what? As Americans are to what?
So the Romans are America?
Mm-hmm. And the Greeks are the English.
Yeah, there is no Greece for America.
It's England. No, it's England.
No, England is not the Greece for America.
Yep. It's the exact same thing, my friend.
No, it's more like, let's see, the Romans, they came from the Trojans who came. Yeah, that's not a good. There is no.
The Romans and the Trojans are the same thing.
Well, I mean, the Trojans were the ancestors of the Romans, right? The people from Troy.
Well, I guess, but I mean, they're pretty similar,
right?
That's like saying the Greeks and the Cretans are different, but they're the same.
No, because the Greeks fought Troy. Remember in the Iliad? And when the Trojans got their asses kicked, they went south, down into Italy. That's where the Aeneid comes from.
The Greeks fought Troy, but the Romans are the Trojans. Wait, no. Troy. Oh, yeah, I don't know about Troy. I don't know.
Aeneid, you know the Aeneid? Aeneas came from out of the Trojan War. And in
that's
his
right.
vanquishment, settled
the
in
Trojans,
Rome.
So the Trojans trace themselves to Troy.
The Romans do.
I mean the Romans.
That's right. So they're the predecessors. So really, I mean, Troy is America. You know, it's the first one. There is England. You can't compare England to the United States. It's just a whole different animal. They're a monarchy. They had a, you know, they're a small, tiny place. They don't even physically compare, you know. There's just nothing like America. I don't know why you hate it so much. Your homeland.
America? Is that what
yeah.
Love
it or leave it. So which part of England are you moving to?
Oh boy. I would like to actually. That would be nice.
We're thinking actually of looking somewhere to live out abroad, but not out of a, you know, desire to leave, just out of a desire to see new things.
You want to go abroad, but not out of a desire to leave.
No,
I guess I know what you mean.
A desire to get there, not to leave.
Right. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh.
So probably not to Haiti though, and hopefully they'll no zombies in my future.
It's a lot of work to do in Haiti.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of work.
Hmm?
You need to still build houses.
What? Build houses,
well,
yeah.
There's a lot of people still living in, like, tents and
right.
No sewage. And it's just god-awful there.
Right.
Well, what do you think?
Yeah, this was good. I'm satisfied.
Very
I'm
good.
Satisfied
yeah,
for I can go for a week now without another conversation.
Well, you know, this takes me back. It takes us back to I forget which one you lived in. Norwood, what was it called? Idis Brow.
Cunningham.
Davidson. Cunningham. Right. Takes me back to Cunningham Hall.
Yeah.
Tedious but thoughtful conversations we used to have.
Did you say tedious?
Tedious.
Yeah. Tedious and thoughtful.
Point to point. Just because it's tedious doesn't mean it's worthwhile. It's not worthwhile.
Right. But those are two words.
Fellowship of the Ring had to go over those snowy mountains.
Mm-hmm. You really loved your... You love your Middle Earth shit, huh?
Well, I don't hate it, but, you know, if the shoe fits.
Well, hobbits didn't really wear shoes, though.
The elf. Elves wear shoes. I was thinking of the elf.
You're more of an elf?
Me? No, I was just thinking of the elf. I'm more of a, like an Aragorn type.
What's an Aragorn?
You know, like a king with a sword.
Oh, yeah, those were basically the humans, right?
Yeah, but the king are the humans.
And that goes right along with you're like America's a superpower, you're the king.
Hey, I'm the king of my castle, man. I've got a
you
queen even and some progeny.
Subject? Progeny.
Yeah. I've got some,
you're doing good?
Yeah, well, you know, it's the way. You know, people say, oh, the miracle of birth. This isn't a miracle. You know, it doesn't take much. Anybody can do it. That doesn't sound like a miracle to me. It's raising the kid. That's the miracle.
Uh-huh. Yeah. All right. Thanks, Roberto.
Hey, well, I got to come over sometime, I guess. Check out your fruit.
Yeah, well, it's almost ripe. It's not quite yet. So I'd give it another maybe 2-3 weeks.
Alright.
Or come anytime. I mean, you don't have to.
Yeah, maybe we'll all come over one of these days. Give you a heads up.
Alright, well, okay, I will send you the link.
Alright. Sounds good. And then what are you posting this on your blog or something?
Well, it's gonna go first of all in on Facebook in the group that I post this on a site called Radio for All. That just as a service to mankind.
Oh, okay.
Post audio.
Yeah.
And then I'll link to it on Facebook. And I might make a blog. Yeah.
Sure, why not? All right, I'll look it up. I'll see your past interview.
All right.
Cool, right on, man.
We still got to talk about conspiracy theories and Facebook.
Conspiracy theories on Facebook?
No, those are two different topics.
Oh, okay. Yeah, sure, anytime, man. Let me know. I got all kinds of ideas.
All right, cool.
All right. All right,
I'll see you, man. Thank you. Thank you.
Right,
yeah, it's been great.
Yeah, right, really good conversation. Take care.
You too. Okay. Thanks.